This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. My last two readings have been about freshwater eel life history and mostly about the eastern North American and European eels, which both reproduce in the Sargasso Sea in the Atlantic and live out their adult lives among us in our streams and ponds and rivers. Today we will visit eels that breed in the Pacific Ocean and live their long adult lives in streams, rivers, ponds, and pools in New Zealand. Anguilla diephenbachii. This book title is Eels, an Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish by James Prosek. It was published in 2011. Prosek is a prolific writer and artist. If you love trout, you may be familiar with his book Trout and Illustrated History that he published while an undergraduate at Yale in 1996. If you love trout, I guarantee you will love that book. He also has since published Trout of the World, all illustrated with his beautiful, vivid watercolors. His last name is spelled Prosek. Today, parts of Chapter 3. He's visiting a woman, Stella, whose father is Maori and mother is English. She has just completed her master's thesis on eels. From the book, Prosek writes, "The Maori worldview acknowledges the interconnectedness of all living things. The colonials, whom the Maori called pakeha, meaning touch of a different breath, tended to dismantle nature, categorize it, and classify it in their lust to find order in nature, to name and possess it. They, for the most part, ignored the nuances of Maori culture and ultimately were successful in their mission, whether conscious or unconscious, to subvert it." And writing of Stella and her sister, he wrote, "I could feel the tension in the room with Stella and Wiki, trying to find their own balance between needing to know their Maori father's past and acknowledging that their mother was English, between science and customary beliefs. And though I had met them only hours before, I could already see that the Maori side of them was winning." He goes on to write, "A tanifa, Wiki said, is something that makes itself known at certain times to certain people, sometimes to warn them of danger, like a guardian. Stella pointed out that the tanifa can assume many shapes, but more often than not, it takes the form of a giant eel. The first written account of a tanifa is most likely the one recorded by Captain Cook on his 1777 voyage to the South Seas, while anchored in Queen Charlotte Sound off of the South Island of New Zealand. Cook wrote the following about statements by a local Maori. We had another piece of intelligence from him, more correctly given, though not confirmed by our own observations, that there are snakes and lizards there of an enormous size. He said they sometimes seize and devour men." Unquote. Maori would not have known a lizard of the size Cook related and would never have seen a snake, as there are no native snakes in New Zealand. What he described, 8 feet in length and big, round as a man's body, was most likely a long-fin eel. Tanifa or not, the long-fin eel is an impressive creature. Like other members of New Zealand's distinct fauna, the now-extinct moa birds, killed off by the first Polynesian settlers for food, more than 12 feet tall, the native kakapo, the world's largest parrot, now endangered, and the largest living insect, a kind of cricket called a waita. The long-finned eel has a tendency toward gigantism, capable of growing to over 80 pounds and living more than 100 years. It is the largest and longest-lived freshwater eel species in the world. The long-fin has been a consistent and available food source for Maori as long as they have been on the islands, and for that reason, along with its impressive stature, it has garnered awe and respect, inspiring a good share of stories. For all his apparent shortcomings, Elsdon Best devoted hundreds of pages of his books to the Maori long association with the eel. Through his work, we are led to believe that the eel is among the most important creatures in Maori culture, outshining the shark, the whale, and the kiwi bird put together. By sheer mass and availability of protein, the eel was at certain times of the year the Maori's most important source of food. Best recorded, more than 300 local Maori words for the freshwater eel in its different life stages. I was yet to see my first New Zealand longfin eel, but Stella assured me that this would soon change. As my guide, she felt that it was important I experience the subjects of our adventure before we started hearing stories about them. About 90 miles west of Hamilton, in a coastal village called Kauhia, an elderly British woman was feeding eels in a small spring-fed stream in her backyard. Such feeding areas were relatively common in New Zealand, but were normally kept quiet to avoid poaching of the valuable eel meat. Traditionally, Maori had sacred eel ponds where the eels would be fed daily. Sometimes the eels were brought to these ponds and kept there with no access to the sea where they would live, some Maori say, for hundreds of years. But most of the time, eels were kept in the pool of a creek or river and could come and go as they pleased. Often they stayed for a long time, perhaps because of free meals or the love that was imparted by the people around them. But the eel's ultimate goal was to store up energy to get to the spawning grounds. No one had yet found the spawning place of the New Zealand longfin eel, though scientists suspected that they migrated to the north and spawned near Tonga over the Kermadec Trench. The eel's life is about travel, Stella said to me as she drove. The only reason they stay in the stream is to store food for their long journey, unquote. The long-finned eel travels from the sea to the headwaters of rivers and streams, spending an average of 30 years in fresh water before returning to the sea to spawn. The eel's movement is universal in Maori culture, Stella said. As the eels move, they leave the path of life behind them. We exited the main highway and drove through rugged farmland to the coast. Intermittent lush green stands of native bush, panga, tree ferns, and tall grasses held on to the slopes of steep ravines, land that could not be farmed. Stella pulled the car off at a convenience store, and I followed her to a back shelf where she grabbed a few cans of dog food. For the eels, she said. How big are these eels? I asked Stella as she brought the cans to the counter. I mean, are they really as long as a person? You'll see, she said. Down the road, a bit further, the smells of the sea became stronger. Stella slowed the car when we were in full view of the ocean. She pulled off the road at a moss-covered gate where a small sign hung. On it was painted a black eel. Stella opened the gate, and we drove down the gravel drive to a modest ranch-style home. Barely visible beside the house was a pool of water that collected seepage from a cold spring. Below the pool ran a small brook choked with watercress. Stella and I got out the cans of dog food and opened them. An old man came out of the house to greet us. "We've come to see your eels," Stella said. "Oh, them eels isn't mine, they're her thing," he said, referring to his wife. Soon the wife appeared and the old man went inside. She introduced herself as Beryl and described how the pool of eels had come to be. "We moved here 10 years ago. The place was covered in blackberry and gorse. When we cleared the yard, we found the spring and dug it out, just enough to hold a few ducks," unquote. Soon the crystal pool was rimmed with a green collar of watercress, and large dark shapes began to appear as if from nowhere, attracted by the bread that Beryl fed her ducks. "I don't know where they'd come from. I guess they'd always been there," she looked into the pool. "They just keep getting bigger and bigger. They're my babies, just like the three bulls, the two goats, the dog, the dozen-odd chickens." The ducks, Beryl added, had relocated to another pond on the property since the eels had showed up. "Are you ready to see some eels?" Stella asked. "Let me get a bit of meat," the woman said. Oh, don't go to the trouble, Stella said. We have dog food. The old woman insisted it was time for her to feed them anyway and soon returned from the house with a bit of steak. She tied the steak to a string, and we watched her wade out into the shallow pool in her gum boots. As she waved the steak in the current, I saw a few large heads emerge from the watercress, seemingly from nowhere. Giving into a natural reflex, I took a step back. Oh, don't be afraid, Beryl said. They won't harm you unless you're holding food. They might bite you by accident. As Beryl lifted the steak on the line out of the water, a huge eel, about as big around as the calf of her leg, lifted its head out, dancing to and fro to keep its body up, not unlike a cobra. Oh, my God, I said aloud, my mouth agape. When she lowered the meat into the water, 5 or 6 big eels, their heads 5 to 8 inches across the back, vied for a piece. They grabbed on, making loud sucking sounds to try to get an advantage on the steak, and then they rolled their bodies to tear pieces off. An eel can rotate 14 times per second. Stella had taken off her flip-flops and was walking barefoot across the grass. She spread the contents of one of the cans of dog food on the grass near the edge of the pool. With a stick, she pushed some of the meat chunks toward the pool. A single big eel came to the rim of the concrete ledge to investigate. It sniffed a few times, then tilted its head and body, propelled itself over the ledge onto the grass, and began taking pieces of the dog food into the side of its mouth. A few smaller eels followed, and soon the grass was wet with slime. I could see their features clearly, wide mouths, broad lips, and nostrils like tubular horns. These eels were big, but the biggest eels in the pool barely approached the ledge, hanging back in the darker depths. Once in a while, I caught a glimpse of a real monster exposing its head from the thick mats of watercress, but never its whole body. Stella squatted on the grass, her long black hair nearly touching the ground, letting the eels glide up between her bare feet, touching one and then another on the top of the head, petting them. And in another part of the chapter, he writes, "Everyone we talked to remarked about the big storms that I had just missed. Stella explained that the heavy rains had probably allowed all the migrating silver eels to go downstream, even eels that had been trapped in ponds and puddles with no access to the sea for many years. Eels will cross over land in wet weather," Stella said. "On rainy nights on the farm, our cat Buddy brings eels up on the porch with their heads munched off. He catches them in the paddocks. His neck is covered in dried slime where the eel wrapped itself around him," unquote. All along the highway, we saw slips where hillsides, stripped of vegetation by grazing sheep, had become oversaturated with moisture and collapsed into rivers and across roads and bridges. Some of the slips looked like avalanches of rock, sod, and mud, maybe with a few sheep mixed in. Riverbanks were cut almost to the steps of homes. Roads and bridges were blocked, and some houses had fallen into the rivers, like one we passed on the Rangitike River. North of Napier, at the far eastern end of Hawke's Bay, is a settlement called Wakaki, where people are known as the Eel People. The Kaumatua we visited at the Marae, the social and religious gathering place for Maori in the Wakaki, was named Walter Wilson. "We've adapted to the eel title," Walter said. "It gives us a distinction. We're thick-skinned and slippery." In the town of Wakaki, there is a lagoon that is separated from the sea most of the year by a bar of sand and gravel about 300 feet wide that Walter called a shingle bar. Periodically, the bar is breached by storms, allowing young eels to enter in spring and mature eels to exit in fall. The unique topographical features of this lake attract the eels, and the Maori have been fishing them there for centuries. From the lawn of the Marae, you could see the lake and immediately beyond the ocean. Walter said that traditionally in spring, the Maori dig a channel from the sea to provide passage for the glass eels into the lake. In autumn, the exodus of adults is more dramatic. The mature eels stage at the ocean side of the lagoon waiting for a storm, and when the big waves are pounding on the beach, they make a break for the ocean in mass, over the shingle bar, sometimes in a huge ball. Walter described this natural phenomenon as Stella and I sat across a table from him in the Marais. He rolled a cigarette from a bag of Port Royal tobacco, lit it, puffed, and deposited the ashes in a paua, or abalone shell. This is when our people fish for the eels, during migration season, when the eels are staging by the lakeshore. The eels are waiting for what we call the tai tipi, the big tides. I wouldn't call it a tsunami or whatever, but it's a big wave caused by a storm out at sea. The eels gather by the thousands. You see them. And when the tai tipi arrives, they go. They go over the land, side by side, over the sand and the shingle. I asked Walter what alerts the fishermen. How do they know when the eels are beginning to gather for the run? He became slightly defensive. I know when to go down, he said. I ain't going to tell you. I can't take you to the place we fish. The trustees would have to decide if that's okay. He paused to tap ashes from his cigarette. Why do you want to know? To explain it? The knowledge is used for money. My opinion is that we give away too much knowledge. By we, he meant the Maori people. He believed, for instance, that the stories told in the recent movie Whale Rider, a modest New Zealand production that had garnered praise from Hollywood, were used illegally without permission. This is Maori intellectual property, he said. Walter, who looked to be in his late 60s, had a reddish face and wore a wide-brimmed hat and a long-sleeved shirt. Stella and I followed him outside the Marais into the bright sunlight. He took us in his truck to the beach a short drive away to see the dunes and the shingle where the eels cross. It was a black sand beach with pieces of white pumice and driftwood. The surf pounded loudly. Walter said he couldn't show us specifically where the eel nets were set. Traditionally, an elder passes on his knowledge to one person before he dies, and that person isn't searched for but makes him or herself apparent. The knowledge is not shared with anyone else. It's just how it's done, Walter said, somewhat apologetically, changing his earlier tone. Then very abruptly, leading us down the sunny beach, he said, "Who owns the sun? Here you are. Come see for yourself." We stood, our clothes blowing like flags behind our bodies. I was looking from the lake to the sea, from the sea to the lake and back, wondering what it would be like to witness thousands of eels crossing the bar. The dunes are so dynamic, Stella said, watching the stiff sea breeze blow the sand into the air. They're always changing. That's nature's artistry, I call it, Walter said, lifting a piece of driftwood from the sand. Noticing that Walter's attitude had softened, I decided to recast a previous question. How do you know when the typhoon is coming? I asked him. The tai tipi. You can hear it, he said. It booms up in the bloody hills. That's how you know it's a tai tipi. The big, big waves come only now and then, and the eels make their way to the crest of the dune at night to catch the wave, and then they go. Once they get on to the ridge of the beach and they're heading down into the sea, they're gone. Walter said that when the eels are ready to leave, they develop a thicker skin, an extra layer, he called it. Their noses become more pointed, their skulls structurally change, and their eyes enlarge and cloud over in a bluish haze. These physiological changes are consistent with ones that other migratory freshwater eels undergo the world over. As we were walking back to the Marais, Walter said to me, "The only reason you're here is because of my connection with Stella's father." We sat in the Marais, our faces flushed from the wind and sun, and Walter made us a cup of tea. When Walter began speaking, I turned on my small digital recorder and placed it next to my notebook without asking permission. I was afraid that if I asked, Walter would say no. "That's why I asked Stella how much you want to know." "Why do you want to know? For public consumption?" Walter said, addressing me. I'm not being rude, that's just a thing. This run of eels happened before Maori got here, before humans got here. As long as the lagoon has been here, that's been happening. What happens here at Lake Waikiki is unique to this part of the world. The only other place that I know that it happens used to be Lake Ellesmere in the South Island. I've never been there to see it, but they tell me that it happens there too. Walter went on to talk about the health of the fishery and how it's managed. For the Maori, the harvest season is mostly during migration, and if 1,000 eels pass through a weir, net, or trap, they take only 100, just the ones that look good to eat. The fisheries regulations in New Zealand, Walter said, were faulty because they managed the fisheries to let the small ones go and keep the big ones. Quote, the problem is that the fish that are released are most often males, because males on average are much smaller, and all the big egg-bearing females are taken. The Crown has the nerve to tell us Maori how to manage a fishery we've been managing just fine for hundreds of years, unquote. Before leaving the Marais, I asked Walter if he had any thoughts about where the eels go once they leave the lagoon for the sea. They're going to die, he said, lighting a cigarette. They're going out there to die. Once they have laid their eggs and fertilized those eggs, they all die, and some sharks out there have a great big banquet. I'd love to see where they go, I said. And I hope you never find out. And as we drove away from the Marais, Stella scolded me. She said that several times during Walter's monologue I had interrupted him to ask him to explain something or repeat something I didn't understand. Stella was adamant that I not interrupt any more of the people we were going to visit. She said, because Maori is an oral language, you are expected to listen. That is your role in the conversation. If it's your turn to speak, they'll listen to you. If you miss something that they say, that's your problem. Don't interrupt to ask them to repeat themselves. And that's where I'll stop reading right now. And I will be reading again next week from this wonderful book about this incredible animal. I'm reading from James Prosek's book called Eels, An Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish. I encourage you to Google New Zealand freshwater eels to see some amazing photographs. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.